All right, if you have a copy of God's Word, I'll ask you to open it back up to the book of 2 Samuel. We are going to be finishing chapter 13. The last time that I preached here, we looked at the first half of the chapter. We dealt with verses 1 down through verse 22. And we saw that Amnon had a dangerous lust for his half-sister Tamar, and that he developed a plan to be around her alone, and during that time that he was with her alone, he forced himself upon her and raped her. And King David heard of the rape and knew what happened, but David never took any action to discipline Amnon. Amnon basically got away with it. But Tamar had a brother. Her brother Absalom was not going to put up with the rape of his sister by his half-brother Amnon. Amnon was the firstborn of David's sons. He was the logical heir to the throne. And so that might have been what kept David from disciplining this son. Plus, David's life hadn't been so stellar lately anyways. He had been found out to have his affair with Bathsheba and have Uriah killed, and he probably wasn't the best person to enact justice upon his son who had committed this sexual crime. So with that being said, Absalom continues on with his brother Amnon like nothing ever happened. For the space of 2 years, he never said anything bad to Absalom. In other words, for 2 years, Absalom treated Amnon like everything was okay. And so that put the kingdom at ease. Okay, Absalom's not going to be vengeful. And so 2 years go by. Now we pick up in verse 23. It says, it came to pass after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shears in Baal-Hazor, which is beside Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold now thy servant hath sheep shears. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant." And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all now go, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. Then said Absalom, "If not, I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" But Absalom pressed him that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not, have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, every man got him upon his mule and fled. And it came to pass while they were in the way that tidings come to David, saying, "Absalom hath slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left." Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men of the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead, for by the appointment of Absalom this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king take this thing to heart and think that the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead." But Absalom fled, and the young men that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said unto the king, "Behold, the king's sons come, as thy servant said, so it is." And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept, and the king also and all of his servants wept very sore. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. Now, as I look at this text, there are four things that I want to divide it into. The first being final revenge. When you look at verses 22 through 29, you're going to see that after 2 full years, Absalom gets revenge on his brother Amnon for the sin of raping his sister. Now, as I look at these verses, I want to go back over them again, in 23 down through 29, and I want us to see that Absalom has had this plot for a long time. He's wanted to see action done, and for 2 straight years, he has seen nothing change in his older brother's actions, and he's seen no response from the kingdom. In other words, there's no justice. Now, we live in a day where people get out on street corners with signs and call for justice. And it's usually justice for some thug criminal that got what he deserved for the actions he was doing. If you get in a fist fight with a group of cops and you die, shame on you. Shame on you. If you put your hands up and you put your hands behind your back and you comply with all the officer's orders, you don't die. Maybe 1 in 1,000,000 accidentally die in that situation. The people that die who fight with the cops die because they fought with the cops. The Bible says that the government doesn't bear the sword in vain. They have the right to do it. Those guys that are protecting you have a right to go home alive every day. People who fist fight and run and try to pull down on the cops are getting exactly what they deserve, and that could end up in the taking of their life. And so somebody gets out here and fights with a group of cops and dies, and people hold up a sign and say justice for some drug-dealing thug. Tamar was not a drug-dealing thug that fought with the cops. Tamar was a virgin daughter of a king who lived a life that was separated unto the king, who was awaiting to be married to someone that was pleasing to her and her family. She was doing everything right, and she was violated by a wicked half-brother. And Absalom said, surely justice will be served. Surely justice will be served. Surely justice will be served. And for 2 years, Absalom waited, and there was never so much as a trial. There was never so much as a slap on the wrist. It was all swept under the rug like it did not happen. After 2 full years of pretending to be friends with the brother who raped his sister, Absalom got final revenge. I want you to notice in the first portion of this text, verse 23, 24, and 25, Absalom is pressing David to come with all of his servants to a festival of shearing the sheep. When sheep are sheared, this is when the wool is collected. And when the wool is collected, this is the valuable part. When garments were all made of wool, when you collected your wool, this is when you cashed in your money. At this particular time, a lot of the older sheep would be slaughtered and eaten. There would be wine, there would be dancing, there would be song, all the workers would be getting paid, all the shepherds would be drawing their checks, and this was a big festival time. And this went, you can find this in the book of Genesis, you can find this throughout the Old Testament. When it was time to shear sheep, everybody was rich and the money and wine flowed. And so Absalom here is saying, Dad, come down to the festival and bring all the people in your court. And you notice that David says, nay, we not all go in verse 25, lest we be chargeable unto thee. He said, son, you know how much it's going to cost you to feed me and all the people on my staff? Imagine you throwing a party for President Trump and the entire cabinet and all of his advisors. You're talking about 50 people, short list. and you want all your brothers there. You're talking about feeding a whole bunch of people. David says, no. I understand you got a lot of sheep. I understand that you are you're shearing them and you're going to have some money, but you're not feeding all of us and throwing a party for all these people. Absalom presses him. He says, no, now you can have the party and all the sons there and you have my blessing and that's a good deal, but we're not all going. So that's when Absalom in verse 26 says, if not I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us. Now Amnon is the crown prince of Israel. In other words, he's the replacement to David's throne. When David dies, Amnon is the rightful guy to step over. So Amnon would be the representative of the king's throne. He said, Dad, if you're not coming, let the second highest power in Israel come, my oldest brother, Amnon. All my other brothers are there. Amnon was probably kept near the palace. Amnon was probably being groomed to take over for David one day. And this would be symbolic not only of all the brothers of the king being at this party, but it would also be symbolic of the king himself being there. So he says, why do you want Amnon? Absalom just kept pressing, because I want this to be about family, about brothers, about the kingdom. David finally says, okay, Amnon can go. Now, when he says Amnon can go, Absalom now knows that the plan is in effect. Absalom planned to do this in the king's presence, but David refused to go. So since David ain't going to be there, he's going to do it in all of his brothers' presence. Absalom wants to make it clear that this execution is necessary because of what's taken place and the absence of punishment, the absence of law and order. And so when people don't feel like they can get justice through the legal system, we have what's called vigilante justice. People take the law in their own hands. This is when you have lynch mobs that take people out of jails and hang them or execute them because they do not feel the legal system works. Final revenge. Absalom's plan says, notice this in verse 28. Mark ye now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him, fear not, I have commanded you, be courageous, be valiant. Amnon's probably a little apprehensive about going to the half-brother's festival, and he raped his sister. I mean, that's an awkward Thanksgiving dinner, isn't it? But the king says, no, all the brothers are going to be there. It's not just you and Absalom going snipe hunting, okay? It's all the brothers. The entire royal lineage is going to be there. You'll be fine. Go as my representative. Do this for the betterment of the kingdom of Israel. So he's a little nervous, and I would be too. You know, if it were me, I'd be carrying two pistols and the hammers would be cocked. And I'd have my hands in my pockets or on my hips, you know, ready. I would look like the guy in the Old West that's fixing to draw and shoot at all times. You know, if somebody popped a balloon, I'd probably get two shots off, you know. That's how nervous he would be. But they start pouring some wine down him. They start getting him a little bit. I didn't say he gets drunk. He just knocked the edge off. Most people don't set out to get drunk. They just want to knock the edge off. Wine is for that. The Bible says wine makes the heart merry. Once he gets relaxed, he's no longer got his hand on his dagger, and he's not constantly looking over his shoulder. He says, then I'm going to give the signal, and you do it because I've commanded you. Absalom's not going to go over there and stab him in the heart. I bet you Amnon wouldn't let Absalom get close to him. Forgive me for not shaking hands. You know, that kind of deal. Let's just wave at each other from a distance, because I don't want to be around you because you'd probably kill me. Even though for 2 years, he never said anything bad to the guy. So he says, be valiant, be brave. I'm going to be the successor to the king. So if you guys do what I tell you to do, you're going to be rewarded for this because I'm commanding it. Verse 29, and the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. And all the king's sons got on their mules and fled. Everybody said, I'm out of here. They're killing brothers in this place. They all fled. So when we talk about final revenge, I want to point out some things to you that really look a whole lot like what David did with Uriah. Do you remember David pressing Uriah to go home and uncover his feet? Go home and prop your feet up, spend some time with your wife? No, I'm not going to do it. Yeah, go home and do it. No, not going to do it. David pressed him and he wouldn't do it. When pressing him didn't work, you know what happened? David threw a feast for him. He said, we're going to have a feast for the Israeli veterans of Israel. We're going to have a feast for all the war soldiers. And so he had a festival just like Amnon put on. I mean, just like Absalom put on for Amnon, David put on one for Uriah. You know what David did at that festival? He poured wine down Uriah the Hittite. He got Uriah the Hittite drunk, hoping that he would go home and sleep with Bathsheba and cover up the fact that David was the one that had got her pregnant. Here's another interesting thing. David didn't physically, actually, personally kill Uriah the Hittite. He ordered someone else to carry it out. You remember that? Absalom didn't personally, physically kill Amnon. He ordered someone else to do that. Boy, this is a coincidence, isn't it? David, here's where it differs. David wanted Uriah dead just as quick as possible because the baby in Bathsheba's womb wasn't getting any smaller. She's fixing to start looking pregnant, and we needed to find some time for mourning of her husband and plan a marriage. David was anxious to get this done. Absalom was cautious and slow, and for 2 years hoped that right would be won out and wrong would be condemned. But for 2 years, Absalom never saw anything change. 2 years of waiting for final revenge. And then at the end of 2 years, Amnon didn't get a slap on the hand, did he? He didn't get reprimanded by dad. He didn't get his allowance taken away. Amnon paid for his crime with his life. And I think he got what he deserved, but he didn't deserve to get it this way. Let's look at our second thought. We see final revenge in 23 through 29. There's a false report in 30 through 36. A false report. Now, I want to ask you a question. Why do we have this long, detailed account of this false report? You see, I've had the privilege of studying this text exclusively for 2 weeks. And I'll confess to you, last Sunday, I didn't have a good answer for this. But I've had a week of sitting around doing nothing. Can't go anywhere. And I've thought about it and thought about after 2 weeks, I want to read this false report. And then I want to give you some reasons for why David was told that all of his sons were dead when in reality it was just a rapist that was executed by the brother of the victim. Now you look with me, verse 30. And it came to pass, while they were in the way, that tidings came to David, saying, Absalom hath slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left. David gets the news that Job got. All of your kids are dead. All their wives are dead. David gets the news that one son has killed all his sons. Why? Look, he arose and tear his garments and lay on the earth, and all of his servants stood by with their clothes and rent their garments. Question, why didn't David say, well, I don't believe that. I don't think Absalom would kill everybody. Why does he respond with mourning and not respond with doubt? Have you ever saw something you just couldn't believe? Have you ever heard something you just couldn't believe? How can David believe that Absalom killed all of his sons? He doesn't respond with doubt. He responds with instant mourning. And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, verse 32, David's brother. This guy's mentioned two times in Scripture. The first time he was mentioned was in last Sunday's sermon in the first part of this chapter, where he says, "Don't worry, Amnon. I've got a plan to get you and your sister together." It was Jonadab that told Amnon to ask David, say, "I'm sick. I want my sister Tamar to come down and bake me a pan of biscuits. And if I had some of them big cat head biscuits made with hog lard, not Crisco, hog lard, and I had a big pan of her homemade biscuits, I'd probably feel better." You remember David said, "What?" But Amnon pressed him. This was all the plan of Jonadab, to put Tamar and Amnon together. And now a false report comes in that all the sons of David are dead. And Jonadab said, "Wait a minute." Jonadab wasn't there. Jonadab's been at home. He's not one of the king's sons. He wasn't invited to the party. He's the king's nephew, not the king's son. Jonadab said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men of the king's sons." He doesn't know this. He's speculating. He says, "For Amnon only is dead, and by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar." Jonadab has known all along that sooner or later, Absalom's going to get revenge. He doesn't know who's dead. The report is they're all dead. And he said, "No, if anybody's dead, it's Amnon. And if anybody killed him, it's Absalom." And he knew this. Some people said, "Well, he must have known. Absalom must have disclosed to him what he was doing." I don't think so. For 2 years, Absalom never said anything good or bad about Amnon. I think Jonadab just knew what was going on. Jonadab knew what was up. And Jonadab should have told Amnon, "Don't go down to the sheep shears. I don't care if you take the royal army. Don't go down to the festival of sheep shears." Verse 33. "Now therefore, let my lord, the king, take this thing to his heart, and to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead." So he's trying to comfort the king by saying, "All your kids ain't dead, just one of them." How comforting is that? "Oh, you didn't lose all your kids, you just lost one. Dry it up. Get over it, you big baby. You just lost one." Can anybody respond to the death of a child this way? No. Jonadab doesn't know what it means to lose something. Jonadab doesn't understand the role of a father any more than David. Verse 34, "But Absalom fled, and the young men that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him." Now the guy that's watching for people to come during the night is looking down the main road to Jerusalem. Main Street. If you're coming to downtown Van Buren, you're coming over the Midland Bridge. So this fella's sitting here and he's waiting for people to come. He's waiting for the king's son to arise. And he hears something behind him and he looks, and coming down Logtown Hill, these people were all at a festival in Fort Smith. Coming down Logtown Hill behind him is a whole bunch of people riding horses or mules. What are they coming from there for? Here's the big question that nobody seems to answer. Why'd these guys come home the back way? I don't have any proof of this. I think they thought they're going to run into some of Absalom's hired men on the way home. I think the people that fled that festival thought Absalom was going to kill every one of them. That's why they all jumped on their mules. That's why they said, "No, let's not go the back way. Somebody's waiting on us. Let's not go the main way. Let's go the back way. Let's avoid any trap that Absalom has for the rest of us." So he looks from behind him. And here comes all these people. Verse 35, shut up, Jonadab. Nobody wants to hear from you. Look at what Jonadab said in verse 35. He said unto the king, behold, the king's sons come. As thy servant said, so it is. Told you so. You don't say, I told you so, when somebody's son dies. This firstborn son. The one he's grooming to take his place. You don't say, see, I told you, you just lost one kid. This is not a time to show out. This is not a time to say, see how accurate I am. This is a time of mourning. This is a time of grief. But we've got this stupid Jonadab saying, no, I know what's going on. I'm smarter than all you guys and I want to show it. And he says it like he ought to be rewarded. Verse 36, and it came to pass as soon as he had made an end of speaking that behold, the king's sons came and they lifted up their voice and wept. And all the king also and all of his servants wept very sore. They wept bitterly. And Jonadab's over here with his chest stuck out gloating. See, I called it. Called it, you just lost one. Nothing to get upset about. That's why you don't hear from this guy anymore. Question, why this detailed account of this false report coming to David? How long did it take? This place where the festival, everything I've read says it's about 12 miles from Jerusalem. On a good mule, and you're the king's sons, you know, you're not riding a bad mule, you're riding a fancy mule. How long does it take a fella on a mule to go 12 miles? I'd say 45 minutes if somebody's trying to kill you. How long does it take the news from the festival to travel from there to Israel? I would say that this mourning and wailing that everybody's dead couldn't have lasted any longer than 15, 20 minutes. Why do we have this paragraph of Scripture about a 15 to 20 minute account of a false report and how people responded? Here's the answer to that. David's lack of remorse for all of the men that fell when Uriah died. Think back to the first part of the last chapter. You remember in chapter 12 where Joab, the general, is sending a report back to David, and he says, we advanced on the city, and the archer shot at the people, and we pulled back, and we lost a group of men. And then he tells that messenger, he says, now if the king says, what in the world did Joab do that for? You tell him that Uriah is dead. And so the messenger told the report, and David's like, why would you get up close to a city and get a bunch of people killed? And he says, well, now Uriah the Hittite died during this too. And then David says, well, the sword can kill one just as much as the other. What a bad stroke of luck for him. That was all the appointment of Uriah, and David had no remorse for Uriah and no remorse for the other soldiers under his care that died while he was trying to kill a man to cover up his own problem. Now David understands the validity. He understands the shock. He understands the mourning and the heartache of not losing your enemy that you want rid of, but losing your sons. Because every one of those men that died with Uriah when they advanced on the city too early and pulled back, every one of them was somebody's son. Every one of them had a mother that cried for the death of her son. Every one of them had a father that cried for the death of his son. Every one of them probably had a wife that cried for the death of her husband. Many of them had kids who cried for the death of their father. And David didn't understand that. And this false report, even though it probably lasted 20 to 30 minutes at most, somebody's got to go wake up Jonadab in the middle of the night and say the king's crying, all the kids are dead. He's got to get dressed and go up to where the king is and say it ain't true. And they got to argue about it. Then Jonadab's going to say, see, I told you so. 30 minutes take place, and in 30 minutes, David is reminded for his lack of remorse for the men who died with Uriah. You know what else happens here in this false report? It shows David's doubts about Absalom. Now, if somebody came and told me, some upstanding young man that never done anything wrong in his life, straight A student, great moral character, loves the Lord, killed everybody in his family, I wouldn't believe that. Oh, I don't believe that. I'd have to see more than just a news report. You know, there's fake news. I don't know if you're aware of that. Some of you may be, you know, might ought to be corrupted beyond correction, but if somebody told me that some upstanding kid killed his whole family, I'd say, oh, I can't believe that. I just can't believe it. David gets a rumor that one son killed all the other sons, and he tears his jacket and skulls down on the ground and says, oh God, I can't live this way. Why does David respond with instant mourning when rumor gets out that Absalom killed every other son in the family? Why does David respond with instant mourning instead of saying, I can't believe it? Why doesn't he respond in shock? I'll tell you why. Because deep down in his heart, David knows what kind of a rotten son Absalom is, and he don't want to admit it. If David falls down on the ground and cries out to God and wallows on the ground because he thinks all of his sons are dead, he should have never sent Amnon down there with him. David was the kind of dad that couldn't say no. I mean, he'd say no, and then the kids would get down and throw a fit in the floor and kick and scream, and he'd get the toy off the Walmart shelf and put it in the cart and shut them up. That's the kind of dad David was. Now, he would go out and kill a giant in hand-to-hand combat, but he wouldn't tell that kid no to anything he wanted. Tamar knew that. Remember before Amnon raped her? He said, why don't you just go ask Dad to give me to you in marriage? At least it would be honorable to be married to you and sleep with you than to be raped against my will, because you know if you asked Dad, he wouldn't withhold me from you. This girl knew that her dad couldn't say no to his boys. And this dad knew that he had a group of rotten boys. And this false report revealed to us who David was, and it reminded David of his wickedness and false response. Number three, why the false report? God's judgment. Remember when Nathan showed up and told David, you're the man that took the sheep that belonged to the little poor guy and didn't use any of your own flock? He said, because you did this, David, that child's going to die, and the sword is never going to depart from your household. The judgment of God was that David's family was going to kill themselves. When David got word that all of his sons were dead, do you know what instantly David was reminded of? God said this was going to happen. He didn't know exactly what was going to happen. He didn't know exactly what that looked like, but he knew that Absalom was capable, and he knew that God had said that this kind of judgment was going to take place. For 30 minutes, David wilted and crumbled under the judging hand of God. Number four, it shows us Jonadab's insight. Jonadab was just a spectator on the outside. Let me tell you something. If you've got plans of killing your brother and he's the crown prince of the country, you don't go tell a fellow like Jonadab what you're going to do. Okay? You don't go tell somebody that's connected to the king, part of the family, hey, don't tell anybody, but tonight I'm going to kill my half-brother who raped my sister. Jonadab was backed off from the family enough to know if Amnon ever gets a chance to be around Absalom, Absalom's going to kill him. And when news broke, Jonadab said, no, that's not what happened. Absalom's not ready to take the throne by force. He just wants justice for his sister. Now you wait. About two chapters, Absalom's going to take the throne by force. He's not ready to do that yet. So we see final revenge. We see the false report. Let's talk about fleeing for refuge. want to deal with verses 37 and 38 here. It says in 37, "But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, son of Ammihud, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. And so Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years." Let me just say this. Only guilty people run. Only guilty people run. I've said it a million times. I'm going to say it until you sit down and watch a few episodes. Watch Cops. The TV show Cops. The men and women of law enforcement. If you watch the TV show Cops, you will understand human nature. You will understand why people are the way they are. 9 times out of 10, it makes good TV on the show Cops if they pull up and tell a guy to stop and he takes off running. And he runs and runs and the cops come and they chase this guy over fences and through back alleys and around the street. And then they get him cornered and they can't find him and they say, "If you don't holler and come out, we're going to turn the dogs loose." Let me give you a word of advice. If you've been stupid up to this point and been running from the cops and they say they're going to turn the dog loose, give up now. The dog goes in there and bites a guy. I saw it yesterday. I was flipping the channels. I run across Cops. I watch it. I'm like, "What's going on?" They're chasing a guy. He crawled up in an orange tree in Stockton, California. And they said, "Get down." Think about Zacchaeus. The Lord walks by. "Zacchaeus, come down." The cops are there. There's 10 of them. The guy's in a tree with a knife and a screwdriver. "You're not going to win. There's 10 cops and a dog. Come down." "Ain't coming down. If you don't come down, we're going to turn this dog loose." Dog looked like our dog Champ. Big old German shepherd looking dog. "And I'm not coming down." "Okay, turn the dog loose." He came down. He came down being drugged by the calf on one side. Then he got beat up and cuffed up. And he's like, "Hey, why'd y'all do all that?" And they said, "Why were you running? Why'd you crawl up in the tree?" "Well, I was scared." If you haven't done anything wrong, you wouldn't be scared. Only guilty people flee from justice and judgment. What had that guy done wrong? Well, a lady just happened to walk from her living room into her kitchen, and that guy had broke open her window and was in her kitchen digging through her drawers. And she called the cops, and he went back out the window, ran 2 houses over, and was hiding in an orange tree. The reason he was hiding in an orange tree is because he just broke into a house. Why did Absalom run to another country? Because he had killed his brother in premeditated murder. I agree he had motives to do it. I agree that Absalom was probably mentally justified in killing his brother Amnon. I agree that Amnon was guilty, but we don't have the right, just because someone's guilty, to circumvent the law and do it ourselves. Unless our life is imminently threatened, we need to let the legal system work things out. Somebody said, "Well, he should have fled to a city of refuge." You see, each tribe under the law of God in the Old Testament, each tribe had a city there that was a city of refuge. And if you accidentally killed somebody, you could run to the city of refuge in your tribe or any neighboring city of refuge. There were 12 of these. There were 12 tribes. There were 12 cities of refuge scattered all around Israel where you could easily get to one. You could go there and a trial could be conducted and you could be found innocent. If it was manslaughter and not murder, you're cutting down a tree and the guy's helping you and the tree falls on him. You didn't mean to kill the guy. It was an accident. But his big brother's just determined to kill you because you fell a tree on him. You run to the city of refuge. Here you find protection. Here a trial's conducted. And the magistrates can say, "Look, they were cutting down a tree. It was an accident. You don't have the right to kill this guy." You could find refuge in a city of refuge if you were innocent. You could get a trial in the city of refuge if you were innocent. Let me tell you something. Absalom wasn't innocent. 2 years after the fact, you had a premeditated plan to murder your brother in cold blood while he was half drunk. You don't get off of that. He couldn't go to a city of refuge, so he went to another country. Here's David's first problem. He married somebody outside of Israel. He married a Geshurite from the nation of Geshur, who was a foreigner. And her dad was Talmai, son of Ammihud, the Geshurite. So, Amnon is dead, but Absalom has an ace in his back pocket. His dad is a king and his mother is a princess. And so he goes to Grandpa's house and stays at Grandpa's house for 3 years. He's the son of a king and the grandson of another king in another kingdom. Now, anybody raise grandkids? Now, grandparents, y'all not going to be honest, but did you ever send your kids to your parents? When I sent my little kids to my mom and dad's house, they came home spoiled. My grandparents never spanked my kids, never said no to my kids, never held anything back from their grandkids. You wouldn't admit that you do that to your grandkids, but you do. So now we've got this little son here, this little boy, who's killed somebody, and he ran to Grandpa's house in the neighboring kingdom and hid out there. And what's Talmai going to do? Why are you here, son? Well, you know your granddaughter Tamar? Yeah. Well, she got raped by my half-brother Amnon. And Grandpa, I did what was right. I killed that fella, and now they're trying to kill me. Well, son, you just stay over here. We'll protect you. That's what happened. How long did he stay there? 3 years. A fugitive from justice. You know what we can take away from this? Time heals all wounds. But justice has no time limit. You know they are still finding to this day in recent years, the last 10 years, they have found Nazi people who were guilty of war crimes from the end of World War II in 1945, and they're finding them in the 21st century. These talking about old men in their 80s and 90s that were 14 and 15-year-old German soldiers. Well, Brother Harold, that's been, you know, golly, preacher, that's been like 70 years. Don't matter. They find your murderer 70 years later. Justice still needs to be served. Now, time heals wounds. It's been 70 years. Yeah, but justice doesn't know time. He's hid out here for the space of 3 years. Now, let's look at our last point. A father's remorse. Verse 39. It said in verse 37, that David mourned for his son every day. He's mourning for Amnon, his firstborn that was dead, every day. Look with me at verse 39. And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing that he was dead. You can't sit around and mourn for the dead forever. You've got to get over it. One thing about the dead, you don't bring them back. You may wish you could bring them back, but you can't. They're dead. Got to move on. So David has a dead son that's buried. And he mourned for him and mourned for him. And then over time he said, you know what? What's done is done. He's dead. But I got another son that might as well be dead because for the last 3 years he's lived in a foreign country. And David wants to go to Absalom, not for justice, not on a manhunt. He wants to go to Absalom because he misses Absalom. He misses the son that killed his firstborn. He wants to be daddy and friends and buddies, and they want to go fishing together. And I miss Absalom. The remorse of David is that he can't go be buddy buddies with his murderous son. He said, Brother Harold, this don't make any sense. David wants him back. And here's the problem. David has no desire for justice. No desire for justice. David failed at punishing Amnon. And let me tell you what's happening. He's failing to punish Absalom. when he failed to punish Amnon, was that better or worse on his family? It was worse. When he fails to punish Absalom, you think it's going to be better or worse on his family? Read ahead. I know I ain't got much to preach on anyways. If you get bored, you can just read the next two chapters and get ahead of us. Just skip chapter 14. It's just a woman that convinces David at the pushing of Joab to go and bring his son back. But when his son comes back, because he was never punished for his crime, because he was never disciplined for killing someone, he's going to come back and attempt to kill his dad and the entire kingdom. Now let me give you the title of my message and some application and we'll close. The title of my message is When Sins Go Unpunished. When sins go unpunished. What's the application, preacher? Well, let's just look at the most obvious application. When you don't punish your children. David could not discipline his own kids, and they were his problem. If you fail to punish your children, to discipline them, to make their actions have consequences, you are going to reap the kind of family that David had. This was God's judgment on David for what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. But the judgment of God wasn't God supernaturally moving things around. It was God letting David reap the results of his own fatherhood. Friend, when you don't organize your home according to the Word of God and you fail to discipline your children, you could expect the exact same things. The exact same things. If you do not have discipline and order in your home, your children are going to act the same way. Here's why. There's no consequences for their actions. If there's no consequences for their actions, then their actions are not weighed before they're acted upon. Application number two, the cops. You ever heard of dirty cops? You ever heard of bad cops? Heard of cops that take bribes, cops that don't enforce the law. Friend, if cops don't do what cops are supposed to do under the law, we are going to have an awful society. People sometimes will say to me, "Where do you pastor at?" And I'll say, "Lee Creek Baptist Church." They'll say, "Where's that at?" I'll say, "Well, you go up 59 Highway and you get to the last stoplight by Dollar General, take a left, go about two or three blocks, and we're on the left." And they'll say, "Oh, yeah, that's where the cops always sit and clock speeders coming through here." And I'll say, "Yeah." And they'll say, "Why do you let cops sit there in your parking lot and catch speeders?" I'll say, "Because when they don't sit there, people go 85 miles an hour down this road, and it's a 35. "Oh, they don't go 85. I said, "That's why the cops sit there." I said, "I've had motorcycles go by so fast, when I heard them and looked up, they were already on the other end, the parking lot." When the cops don't sit here for a few months, the speed out here, and there's no shoulders on this road. There's wrecks all the time on this road. If the cops said, "You know what, we're no longer going to sit in the Lee Creek parking lot and catch speeders anymore," you might as well just make it a racetrack out here. You see, if cops don't punish violators of the speed limit, this would be too dangerous of a place for you to drive. You are going to reap the results of sins going unpunished. Let's talk about our court system. We talked about children. We've talked about cops. Let's talk about courts. What happens when people are caught by the cops? The cops did their job. They caught them. They take them to court, and the judge says, "Go on back out there and try again." If the courts no longer punish criminals, don't expect the criminals to police themselves. The Democratic Party is pushing for a country with no law. You want me to tell you why they're doing that? When this country turns to absolute chaos, they will turn the military up on it and put it under Socialism, communism, Nazism, you pick your ism, that's where it ends up. When there's no law, the military becomes the law, and the party in power rules the people. Now, I'm no prophet, but I've read enough history books and slept through enough high school history to know what's happening. We've got to have law and order. People who break the law have to be punished. I don't care what the crime is. If it's against the law, it's punishable. If you start picking and choosing which laws you're going to enforce, which laws you're not going to enforce, you're going to end up with a group of people just like the sons of David. You're going to end up with a family that looks more like a soap opera than a godly Christian home. You're going to end up with a nation of every man for himself instead of a nation where we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now listen to me. There are times for mercy. There are times in your home when you don't have to beat your kids to death. There are times when the cop can come to your window and say, you know what, you got a clean driving record, you're not wanted for anything, you seem like you got everything in order, you made a bad decision, I'm going to give you a warning and let you go. There's a time when you go before a judge and the judge says, look, it looks like you've made a couple bad decisions. Do you want to try to get your life back together? Then let's just pretend this never happened and you go out on probation and show us that you can live a good life and we'll act like your bad decisions never happened. There's a time for mercy. But friend, premeditated murder and rape are not times of mercy. Those are times of justice. David did not respond. In your life, in your home with your kids, with the cops, with the courts, they're time for mercy. But there must be justice for those who do not warrant mercy. Now, that's a very good practical illustration, preacher. Thanks a lot, but what does this have to do spiritually? Heaven is different than earth. Drastically different. Well, I know they got streets of gold, and I'm going to get a cabin on a hilltop just over in the glory land. No, the difference in heaven is not the building material. It's not even that the Son of God is the light. The difference in heaven is this. The difference between heaven and earth is this. There is absolute justice in heaven. Absolute justice. Well, Brother Harold, but God's merciful and God's loving. You're absolutely right. But everyone that is in heaven has been justified by the sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ. Their sin debt is paid completely. Their sins are gone. They've been redeemed. They're a brand new creature. There are no sinners in heaven in the present tense. You know what that means? In heaven, there'll never be an Amnon, and in heaven, there'll never be an Absalom. These events of rape and murder never take place among a redeemed group of people whose sins have been borne by the Lord Jesus Christ. They're new creatures. They've been redeemed. They've been regenerated. So guess what? We're going to a place where justice is pure and perfect, and we are the recipients of mercy and grace. Well, Brother Harold, I just don't know if I'd want to spend an eternity in heaven with you. Well, hon, I got good news. I'm going to be different when I get there. And praise the Lord, you will be too. Heaven's different. Well, Brother Harold, I just can't wait till we get there and everything's right. I know, but here's the reality. Until you get to heaven, you're living on this earth with an Amnon and an Absalom and a bunch of Davids raising brats that you have to listen to in the grocery store. Hey, they may be bringing them to your house, Grandma and Grandpa. Oh, I know, your kid never raised brats, I understand. Point I'm making is this. If you are a child of God, He's not raising brats. God's not David. Some people treat God like he's a father like David. He would never tell me no. God would never say no. God would never get mad at me. God would never get involved in my life. God would never do anything that would take away or make me unhappy. God's like a cosmic grandpa. He just wants to teach me how to spit and how to whittle and give me good stuff. No, sir. God's name is the Father with a capital F, and he is a father like none you've ever seen on the earth. So here's what that means. God punishes sin. Sin does not go unpunished. These things that are happening to David is the direct punishment of God because David sinned. Here's the question that you need to answer before you put your head on the pillow tonight, even if it's for your last time. Does God punish you? Does God punish you? I'm not asking if he had one of your kids kill another kid. Here's what I am asking. Does God ever punish you? I'll tell you something. A little confession time. People like it when the preacher confesses. It makes them feel good. Right before this COVID quarantine, about Monday, 2 weeks ago, I was going about my merry way, and God got my attention. And he humbled me. And he brought me to a place where I said, okay, Lord, it's obvious. I have not been living the way I should. I've not been praying like I should. I've not been studying like I should. I've not been reading my Bible like I should. I've neglected all of these areas of my spiritual life. And I've been getting along pretty good without it. Nobody came up to me and went, Brother Harold, I just don't think you're what you used to be. Everybody was fooled, myself included. But God wasn't. And here's the good thing about God. He's not the kind of dad that's raising a brat. So when I started acting like a brat, God got down on my level and he got my attention. And he said, son, you're my kid and you're not going to act like this. The world don't know what's going on, but I see it and you're going to get it straightened out. Man, I got down on my knees and I wept before God and I begged God to forgive me. I begged God to forgive me, to return me back to the spiritual life I used to have. And you know what? He did. Man, I got up off my knees and I felt 10 foot tall and bulletproof. I thought, man, I feel so saved right now. I ought to go to war. Nobody could touch me. Man, I got me a good series wound up for Wednesday nights. I had done a bunch of study. God was really opening and everything. I said, man, we're fixing to get into a great study. I was fired up about it. Punishment started right then. I tested positive for COVID. No, you got you a good message, and you've had forgiveness, and you've had a little spiritual revival in your own personal life, but you're going to sit at home for 10 days by yourself. Think about what you've been doing. You say, Brother Harold, how bad was your sickness? Well, I never felt a thing. I was asymptomatic, they call it. But it wasn't that I needed to be labored and breathing and run a fever. It was that I needed to be isolated by God and experience the difficulty of my actions. Now, here's the good news. Every day when I pray, you know what I say? Thank you for giving me a good spanking 2 weeks ago. Because if you hadn't have gave me a good spanking 2 weeks ago, I'd still be the brat I was 3 weeks ago. You know what that tells me? He's my father. I'm saved because God's intervening in my life and he wants me to grow up and be a mature Christian. You know what that tells me? I'm not the brat running up and down the aisle at Walmart and going, boy, if that was my kid, I'd drag him in the bathroom and I'd kill him. Wouldn't be nothing in there but a pool of tears when I got done. But I don't do that. That ain't my kid running up and down the aisles. My God gets involved in my spiritual life because he's my father. He doesn't just say, Harold, we're going to fix it and you're forgiven and I pointed it out. He says, Harold, because you've done it, son, I've got to remind you that these actions have consequences. And he spanks me every once in a while. You know why? I need a spanking every once in a while. Friend, does God ever spank you? Now, God never spanked me, and I was like, what was that for? I didn't deserve. No, when God gives you spanking, he tells you, here's what you done wrong. Here's why you're getting a spanking. And the spanking is so you don't go back and do wrong again. When I'm tempted to go back to a life of arrogance and pride, self-assurance, I think about them 10 days of sitting around doing nothing. And I was like, no, I don't want to go back down that road again. Last time I did that, Daddy took his belt off. That's what God is doing to David. And David is not a responsible father. Do not look at your life and think that you can be a Christian and that you're doing so good that God doesn't ever need to get involved with you, doesn't ever need to spank you, doesn't ever need to give you an attitude adjustment. Because if God's not doing that, there's only one reason. He doesn't have a father relationship with you. Because he's not raising brats. He's raising Christians to go to a place where justice is served in Jesus Christ. And if your sins have been borne by Christ, then God's going to ensure that you start looking like his child while you're here. So if you don't see that evidence in your life, let me give you this advice. Go home. Get down on your knees. Turn the stupid TV off. Get down on your knees and say, God, all along I thought we were father and son or father and daughter. But I've been over here living my own life, doing whatever I want, and nothing's happened. I don't have an appetite for the word. I don't have an appetite for fellowship. I don't have an appetite for prayer. I don't have an appetite for any of these things. I'm just getting along. And Lord, I'm concerned that you're not treating me like a son because I've been pretty bratty toward you and you ain't been the least bit concerned about what I'm doing. Let me tell you something. If you're God's child and you say, Dad, I've been getting away with a bunch and you ain't been punishing me, he'll say, well, that preacher pointed that out, son. That preacher pointed that out, daughter. You can be forgiven. I understand. Sometimes Dad's merciful. I ought to whip you, but I'm not going to do it. You learned your lesson. If you're not a child of God and you realize it and you've sat down and you said, Lord, I don't have that kind of relationship with you, then here's what you should do. Confess yourself to be a sinner, that you've been believing a lie, that you've never really known God, and ask God to forgive you for Christ's sake. Believe that Jesus Christ, his life, his death, and his resurrection was sufficient for every sin you've ever committed or will commit. And ask God to forgive you and receive you into his family and be your father and discipline you when you get out of line. You know what he'll do? He'll do it. Nobody that comes to Christ is cast out. The problem is, we won't go to Christ. Today you realize you need to be with Christ.